Yes? No?
Yes, I'm here, I'm seeking better updates.
All right. All right, and, yes, all right, very well. Counsel, we'll hear that case first, so go ahead and have a seat. And the second case is In Re Parental Responsibilities Concerning AM. Are counsel present ready in that case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well, thank you. We'll take that case second. While you're getting situated, let me simply review the ground rules with you briefly in case you haven't argued here in a while. This case is set, all these cases are set for 15 minutes per side. The appellant may reserve whatever part of the 15 minutes you wish for rebuttal. You'll be guided by a lighting system on the podium, which works as follows. When the time commences and you start your argument, the light will turn green. After 10 minutes have expired, the light will turn amber. And after the full 15 minutes have expired, the light will turn red. You'll be guided by a clock that counts backward from 15 on the podium, so you can keep track of the time yourself. We have read the briefs in your cases. We're familiar with the facts as you set them forth. So to the extent you wish to proceed directly to your legal argument and omit the discussion of facts, that's fine with us. But the case is yours to argue as you wish. We would ask you to stay close to the podium, please, because we're recording your arguments. We find it helpful occasionally to go back and listen to them again. And if you stray from the podium, your voice will not be picked up well by the recording device. Also, just to let you know that the arguments are available over the internet within a day or two following today's oral argument. So if there is information of a confidential nature that you don't want to have aired over the internet, be advised accordingly. Finally, if anybody in the audience has a cell phone or a pager or some other electronic device, please ensure it's turned off. We're ready for argument.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is David Cook. I'm an assistant city attorney for Denver, and I represent the Denver County Board of Equalization, the appellant in this case. We're asking this court to overturn the decision of the Colorado Board of Assessment Appeals on the basis that it erred as a matter of law in granting the taxpayer below's petition. As I understand you have read the briefs, I'll try to cut to the chase a bit. Colorado gives special tax treatment to agricultural land. That's set forth first in the state constitution, and it's further ratified and clarified by state statute. The break is that you determine a value based on what's being taken from the land. The long and the short of it is, it's a very good deal to have an agricultural classification on your property from an ad valorem tax standpoint. In this case, below, the taxpayer is a Delaware limited liability company known as CP Bedrock LLC. They're a commercial real estate investor and developer, and they're located at 224 12th Avenue in New York City. They own the property upon which the taxes are disputed. A lot of developers will make sure that when they purchase land, they keep that land in the most beneficial tax category for as long as possible. So you may notice as you drive out to DIA, you might see some cows fenced in, or you see some winter wheat. This really serves a couple of purposes. It can keep the tax rate low while development is ongoing, and it also can provide some agricultural land at very short rents to farmers who want to rent that land. So there's some good benefits there, and there's nothing illegal or immoral or inappropriate about this. It's a smart use of the current tax structure in Colorado. Some of the properties that CP Bedrock LLC has developed that you may have seen out there now include, and this is from public record, a 7-Eleven convenience store, a Chase Bank, McDonald's restaurants. This is the evolution of development in Colorado. Again, it's just good business. But in order to get this beneficial treatment, you still have to meet some requirements. The one that came up in this case was, in order to get the agricultural classification for the, let's say, current tax year, you must have been engaged in agriculture in the two prior tax years as well as the current tax year. Then you have to demonstrate that you can do that. In the case at hand, the taxpayer stipulated that it had not engaged in agriculture on the property. stipulated that there were no crops planted, cultivated, harvested, no livestock grazing during 2006. And because of that lack of activity during 2006, the Board of Equalization found that it was not entitled to the beneficial tax treatment for 2007 and 2008 because it didn't have the qualified activities. So under the Constitution and the statutes, that would essentially be it. You don't meet the two-year requirement, you're out. But in 1996, the Colorado Supreme Court created essentially a safe harbor. And it said that if your parcel on which you don't have qualified activity is part of a larger agricultural unit, you can essentially attribute the activities elsewhere in that larger agricultural unit to the parcel that doesn't have the activities. In that case, Douglas County Board of Equalization versus Clark, and there's a companion case, Mission Viejo, with that. In those decisions, the taxpayer owned all of the parcels. They also have to be contiguous parcels. The taxpayer owned all of those parcels. And so the court made this new remedy, or I described it as a safe harbor. The court did not use that term, but that's how I described it, which is tax lingo generally. In the current case, the taxpayer has said, even though we didn't have qualified activities on our property, we rented to a person who rented from others on which that farmer, Wayne Miller, had qualified activities. So we should get the beneficial tax treatment that those other landowners get because Mr. Miller rented from us and rented from them. This goes far beyond the Clark case. Our position is that Clark didn't say that at all. Now, Clark did not say this is limited to situations where a single taxpayer owns the parcels. But that's what the underlying facts were. And the Board of Equalization is saying that decision should be limited to its facts. Instead, the Board of Assessment Appeals has said, we're going to broaden this court-created safe harbor to now apply to a completely different situation that is not the situation that the Colorado Supreme Court addressed. And that's where Denver has cited its objection. So under the Clark case, really two rules come out of that. The first is that a property owner may meet the used previous 2 years requirement through an agent. So if I am a landowner, taxpayer, I don't actually have to go dig the dirt or feed the cows. I can rent to a farmer who does that, and I get those activities attributed to me. That was through Board of Boulder County Board of Equalization versus NBC Construction. It was also addressed in Clark. That's not an issue here. We agree that essentially you can employ agency to get these the behavior that you need to meet the tax qualifications. The second prong of Clark brought in this larger agricultural unit notion. And that's where they said, where you have land that is contiguous with other parcels, and that land is part of a larger agricultural unit on which qualifying activities have occurred during the relevant tax years, the subject parcel will be deemed to have met the requirements. That's as far as Clark and the Colorado Supreme Court went. The legislature has not taken any action that I'm aware of in response to the Clark case. It certainly hasn't expanded that safe harbor, nor has it limited it.
So therein lies my question. If this is not particularly addressed in Clark, and I take it that you're saying there's no language in Clark that we could point to go your way, which is that the Clark should not be expanded to allow the larger agricultural unit to be based on what the tenant has. What can we do with Clark? How does Clark help your argument?
Well, I'm not so sure that it's that Clark helps my argument as much as Clark sets the high watermark.
And how do we know that's a high watermark?
We really don't, without inquiring of the state Supreme Court. I look at the facts that are in Clark, the facts that were addressed. The court clearly, I think, looks strongly at the public policy, which does underlie a lot of the agricultural issues in Colorado. They looked at Clark had activities on its own properties that were contiguous to other property that it owned, and concluded, I believe, that Clark had an agricultural operation going and that you should, in essence, be allowed to attribute the various activities. In this case, the taxpayer itself doesn't farm, doesn't have farm activities. It rents, it rented, I believe it was 37 acres to Wayne Miller, who also rented 560 acres of other properties from other owners. And CP Bedrock is coming in and saying, we should get the benefit of those tax benefits that those other taxpayers get. We should somehow have a connection through Mr. Miller. He's not the taxpayer here. He is a renter lessee.
But you've already acknowledged he's an agent.
I certainly have, Your Honor. The case law does say that the activities can be conducted through an agent.
So why does it matter that he's not the taxpayer, if he's acting on behalf of the taxpayer?
What matters is that this changes the landscape of Clark to say that the benefits that go to taxpayer A, irrespective of agency, now go to another taxpayer because they rented to a common tenant.
But wait a minute. Sorry, maybe I missed your last statement. The benefit doesn't go to Mr. Miller.
Not at all.
Okay, I misunderstood your statement.
No, the benefit goes to CP Bedrock, the taxpayer. They want the benefits that these other landowners get, and they believe, and actually the Board of Assessment Appeals found, they get those tax benefits of a different taxpayer because they rent it to a common tenant.
In this situation where we've got, if as you say, Clark doesn't answer the question, the statute doesn't answer the question, don't we provide some deference to the agency in making?
You certainly give deference as to factual findings and the expertise necessary to make factual findings. In this case, it is a legal issue, and deference is not warranted on legal issues. This court looks at legal issues de novo, and we suggest that that's what is here and that this is a case of first impression in that regard.
But aren't we supposed to construe the tax code in favor of the taxpayer?
Oh, not necessarily. These are...
In ambiguous questions.
I'm not sure it's an ambiguous question at all. The question is quite clear. The question really is, how far did the Supreme Court go when it made this safe harbor?
The question is clear. The answer is...
The question is clear. The answer maybe is ambiguous. But the question really is, how, when the Supreme Court made this law, how far did they intend to go? Our position is they intended to go far enough to meet the facts that underlie that case. Had they intended to go farther, they certainly could have put in a broad statement. And by the way, you can take advantage of this by leasing or renting to a tenant who also leases from someone with qualified activities. They certainly could have brought it up. In fact, the facts were narrow, the decision was narrow. And that's the extent of the authority that's out there to utilize this larger agricultural unit. It's not legislative. It's not in the Constitution. It's something that the state Supreme Court crafted for that case.
But sorry to interrupt. What relevance does the use have of, let's say, this particular parcel? The fact that it's all within Mr. Miller's ranch, this parcel had, during 2006, absolutely no use as far as an agricultural purpose. Does Clark get into that discussion a bit?
Well, only insofar as Clark recites that you can have qualified activities through a third party to whom you rent or lease. That was as far as they went. But I remind the court that Mr. Miller's not the taxpayer. The taxpayer is CP Bedrock, and they want tax benefits that belong to other unrelated tax entities. And they say that they should get them because they happen to have leased to the same tenant who leased from these other entities who got the tax benefits. And that is absolutely different from what happened in the Clark case. That is brand new, uncharted territory.
But there was discussion, let me go back to my question and try it again. There was discussion in Clark throughout that talked about different parcels having different uses, if as long as it has some agricultural relationship. For example, there may be grazing where the cows don't graze on one particular parcel, but that's part of the overall ranch. It's reasonable that there was no fence separating them, there was no highway separating, those kinds of things. So the court seemed to rely a bit on use. I think they called it a second test.
The court did rely on use, Your Honor, but...
That has no bearing here?
It has some bearing, but also the court relied on, in Clark, each of those parcels was owned by the same taxpayer, and they were allowing a taxpayer to have qualified activities on some of its land and essentially have that cure the lack of activities on others. In this case, the taxpayer, CP Bedrock, did not have any qualified activities on any of its contiguous properties. It just didn't have them at all. And so the Board of Assessment Appeals has said, even though you lack the activities, we're going to let you take the benefit of activities of another unrelated taxpayer. And that is the difference. And that's, in our opinion, the important difference that requires that this case have been decided differently. If there's nothing further, I'd like to reserve my last minute and 30 seconds.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Gurgianoff, registration 1324, appearing on behalf of the taxpayer, CP Bedrock, and I'd also like to introduce, sitting at council table with me, Mr. Barry Goldstein. He's co-counseling with me, and he actually conducted the proceedings, evidentiary proceedings, before the Board of Assessment Appeals. I'd like to clear up a repeated misstatement of fact that Denver has made, and he states it also. Denver also states in his reply brief, in the middle of the page 4, that the taxpayer had no other qualified property, no other properties that had agricultural activities being conducted on them during 2006. That is patently wrong. As the BAA found, there were activities on over 300 other acres that were operated and worked by Mr. Miller. In addition to the 37 acres that's the subject property and the subject of today's appeal, there were approximately 313 acres that were found farmed by Mr. Miller. The board held that, and you'll find that in the board's order on page 199 at the bottom of the page. The board says very clearly, Miller was already farming other property for the taxpayer. Now, it's very important that you take notice of that fact and that finding, because 398108 sub 2 says that if a Board of Assessment Appeals decision is against the county, as it was today, unless the BAA recommends that the matter is of statewide concern or will result in a significant decrease in total valuation of the county may only appeal alleged procedural errors or errors of law. The court then is bound by the statute to accept every one of the BAA's findings of fact.
Mr. Gurgianoff, let me just make sure I've got what you've just said correctly here. So what you're saying is that even though Mr. Miller was farming other parcels, some of those other parcels, aside from this parcel, were owned by CP Bedrock.
Correct. That is correct. Hundreds of acres, Your Honor. This the subject property, along with these hundreds of acres, you'll see in the testimony given by Stephen Honeck during the evidentiary proceedings, has been farmed continuously without exception since the 1950s. The exception, forgive me, is 2006. Now,
Mr. Gurgianoff, is the other property that CP Bedrock owns contiguous to this parcel?
It is. And you'll see that in the Fourth Amendment to Exhibit A in Volume 1 of the record below. Let me see if I have a page number. I do, page 62. This case is very Doric. All you have to do, given the BAA's findings of fact, is take a look at the pigeonholes that those facts have to stick in. And those are all found in 391102 sub 1.6 sub A sub Roman 1, wherein agricultural land is defined. It's defined to include property, whether used by the owner of the land or a lessee. The legislature has expressly determined that a lessee can engage in activities such as farming, such as ranching, and the owner, not the party engaging in the activities, the owner will receive the tax benefits of those activities. Agricultural land is property used by the owner or the lessee, which is a parcel of land, whether located in an incorporated or unincorporated area, and regardless of the uses for which the land is zoned, that was used, as council indicated, in the current year and the previous 2 years for farming or ranching. Now, if there is no agricultural use on the property in a particular year, the statute says that'll be excused if the non-use is as a result of conservation practices. The Clark case adds to that and says that the non-use is excused if the parcel in question is part of a larger agricultural unit. Now, if you review the Board of Assessment Appeals decision and you accept their findings as you should, as the legislature wants us to do, you have to conclude that the property is a parcel that was used in the current years, 2007 and 2008, for farm or ranch purposes. It was not used in 2006, but the board found that the property, this is a factual question, the board found that the property was part of a larger agricultural unit. But the board didn't stop there. It could have, and the analysis would be at an end. The board went further and concluded that the property was enrolled in a conservation program. The statute says, that defines agricultural land, that if the property is in the process of being restored through conservation practices, it shall qualify as agricultural land even if there aren't qualifying agricultural activities on it. Now, it's very important that the court make notice of the fact that the statute only requires that the property be placed in a qualified agricultural plan.
Wasn't that done in 2000?
It was approved. The board concluded, however, that the property was placed in the plan. It was placed actually, I think, in the around 2001. The actual approval might not have been, you may be right, Your Honor, might not have been published until 2007. But the board concluded that because it was placed in the plan, it qualified under the statute.
So is that even necessary to look at, if, assuming that the requirements under Clark are met?
Correct. That is not necessary. I want to also point out, as far as agricultural practices are concerned, that Clark was decided prior to an amendment to the statute concerning conservation practices. Clark brings to the table and illuminates for us is the definition of parcel, agricultural use, and conservation practices. Now that last prong, conservation practices, wasn't explained in any detail in the statute when Clark was decided in 1996. That came subsequently. The legislature saw fit to amend the statute to make clear that if your property is placed in a qualified plan, you get the benefit of agricultural classification, even if your property doesn't have qualifying agricultural activities on it.
But your contention is that the overall property did have qualifying agricultural activities on it.
It did. And Clark doesn't explain, and the statute on its face doesn't explain, whether the property has to be in a plan that has actually formally, de jure, if you will, approved by the governmental authority, the federal program or the local district program. Now, I've got 6 minutes left. I think the case is very simple. You could keep the ball on the ground and just go with the board. The board's decision has a reasonable basis in law, as we know from the standards of review. Rieke and Lee say that where the agency's determination on a question of law has a reasonable basis in the law, it shouldn't be disturbed. And as I've just explained and demonstrated, the board's decision eminently qualifies or satisfies that standard. But the white elephant in the room here is an issue that the board didn't touch upon but was argued by the taxpayer below. Denver engaged in activities that the board found prevented agricultural activities in 2006. That the evidence in the record is very clear that but for those activities, this property would have had agricultural activities on them in 2006. What happened in October of 2005, and the Denver glosses over, if not completely ignores, is that the fences were removed from the property, preventing ranching activities. The board found that the removal by Denver of the fences on the eastern, I believe it was the eastern border of the subject property, made ranching activities impossible. Denver was in the process of widening Keller Road, which was runs on or near the property. And when it was widening the road, it took down the fences, and the taxpayer's lessee could not engage in agricultural activities as far as ranching was concerned. But it didn't stop there, because what they did is engaged in a construction project that the board found started in January 2006, and the construction piece concluded in August of 2006, a construction project involving the Irondale Gulch, a drainage ditch involving an 80-foot wide ditch into which was placed an 8-foot in diameter pipe that ran across the subject property. The board found that that construction project prevented Mr. Miller from farming the property. The taxpayer couldn't have ranching activities, so he changed it over, changed his lease, allowed Miller to farm it. When that, almost at the same time when the taxpayer did that, Denver prevented the farming activity. So what Denver effectively is asking you to do, I think would be a travesty. It would be a great injustice. It would be a threat to the integrity of the court. It would work at a tremendous unfairness to the taxpayer. What we're talking about is a value here of what, if the classification is lost, the property is going to be valued probably, well, Denver was asserting the value was $4,031,600. With the classification in place, the value of the property is $3,000. And the tax that the taxpayer has to pay is based on the productivity of the land, which is going to be substantially less than the amount that is going to result if the board is reversed. What you should do is deny the relief that Denver is asking, because the inability to have these qualifying agricultural activities was driven by Denver. They come onto your property, take it over lawfully, prevent you from doing something for tax purposes, and then come back and say, oh, by the way, you owe more money for your taxes. That is patently unfair. And I think the Shell Western case, the last argument in the brief, supports the conclusion that in a property tax case, equity has a role. In the Shell Western case, equity prevented the running of a statute of limitations against Dolores County because of the taxpayer's conduct. This is akin to that fact pattern, except for the inappropriate conduct in issue is the county and not the taxpayer. I feel so strongly, the taxpayer feels so strongly about this point, that we urge the court to embrace this argument, apply the Shell Western case in the principles that it embodies, affirm the Board of Assessment Appeals, and publish this decision under Rule 35F. It involves a novel set of facts applied to established principles. If you have nothing further, I have concluded my arguments.
The Board of Assessment Appeals found, and I quote, there is no requirement that the larger unit must consist of only contiguous properties owned by the petitioner. That's the legal question. Can you have this beneficial tax treatment where you don't have other contiguous properties on which you are conducting qualified activities.
Well, there seems to be a dispute in the record of, or in the argument about whether the taxpayer, pardon me, had other property that they in fact leased out that was contiguous to this that was in fact farmed.
Your Honor, that wasn't clear in the record at all. The board, I would look to the board's decision. Had that been the record below, I don't know why the Denver would have gone forward with the case if they could come in and show that they had this other property. I mean, Denver is aware of what the Clark decision says. So I would just say that what we have is what's in the decision, and that's not what I see in the decision. As to the argument that Denver somehow created the situation, the board found that the fence was taken down to widen Tower Road, as such you couldn't graze cattle, but you could do other activities. For the 8 months that the ditch was worked on by the Urban Drainage and Flood Control District, Denver Public Works, Town Center Metropolitan District, that at most involved 40% of the property, leaving the rest unaffected for the entire year and the remainder for 4 or 5 months. With that, I ask that the decision be overturned. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments this morning. Case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.